And husband versus Dr. W. Dennis Strick.
May it please the court, Ms. Bonnie Wolf will open for Kitchener, Ms. Sue Walker will argue as an amicus curiae, and Mr. Johnny Cullen will close.
May it please the court, this case arises from complications that developed following treatment and transfer surgeries that were performed at Dean McKinley by Dr. Dennis Strickland. McKinley claimed that Dr. Strickland failed to obtain informed consent prior to each of these surgeries. The first surgery was to correct a problem with the thumb on the right hand. The complication as a result was loss of motion in her index finger. The second surgery, 10 days later, was to correct a problem with her index finger. The complication that developed was that she developed a problem then the middle finger on the right hand. Since tendon transfer surgery is a non-listed procedure, this case is governed by Article 4590I, Section 6.02 of the Medical Liability and Insurance Improvement Act of 1977. The title of that provision is Theory of Recovery. The specific language of that statute is that in a suit against a physician involving a health care liability claim, it is based on the failure of the physician to disclose the risks and hazards involved in the medical care of the surgical procedure rendered by the physician. The only theory on which recovery may be obtained is that of negligence in failing to disclose the risks or hazards that could have influenced a reasonable person in making a decision to give or withhold that consent. There have been two Supreme Court cases since that statute interpreting that provision in non-listed cases. The first was Peterson versus Shields. The holding in that was that this statute abolishes the reasonably prudent physician standard of disclosure or the common law locality rule with a reasonable patient rule. Barclay versus Campbell in 1986 followed Peterson versus Shields and set out more specifically what the issues are in these cases of informed consent. In Barclay, it was established the doctor did not disclose the risk. It was also established that Barclay developed the condition that he wasn't warned of. This court held that the situation, in that situation, the remaining issues were whether the risk was inherent in the medical procedure performed, and then whether this inherent risk, if any, could influence a reasonable person in making the decision to consent to the procedure. McKinley relied on that statute and those two cases in drafting her issues and submitting it to the jury. The jury found that the limited extension of the index finger and scarring of the tendon were inherent risks of the first surgery, that those risks could influence a reasonable person in making a decision to consent to the procedure.
Counsel, yes. What language in Barclay do you say that there are only two issues and none other that are submitted in these types of cases? What did Barclay suggest to you that proximate cause is not an issue?
On page 10 of that opinion, the court said these two issues.
These two issues. But you read that to say and none other and proximate cause is it?
Well, I think if the issue is what could influence a reasonable patient in making a decision, and that follows the statute, if you then impose a traditionally defined proximate cause issue, it makes no sense.
Isn't this a negligence action and proximate cause always an element in the negligence action?
I think that a negligence action that is distinguished and even distinguished by the Court of Appeals in Dallas, I don't think you can fit informed consent cases as defined by the statute into the traditional negligence cause of action in the sense of proximate cause. I mean, the problem in this case is that labels are being used without looking to the specific statutory language and the essence of the matter involved. There is causation in these issues that submitted. There was causation in Barclay. There's causation in that the risks are inherent to the procedure. There's causation in that disclosure could influence a reasonable person or the materiality, and that's the issue that really is crucial here. Then there's further causation in the fact that those inherent risks developed from a Janine McKinley as a result of the surgery. Not as a result, I mean, it's real frustrating when these labels have been used, but strict liability is not what we're arguing. We're not arguing that if he fails to disclose the inherent risk, that anything that happens that's adverse after that, he's responsible for. No, only those risks that she actually developed as a result of the surgery, he's responsible for, because she didn't have the right to make the decision for herself.
Now, why don't you make that inquiry of the jury?
Okay.
Why don't you make, why did you object so strongly that the jury should not be even asked?
Because the question, the ultimate question for the jury is whether or not it could influence a reasonable patient, not whether it would influence this particular patient. The degree of materiality is what the issue is, both of those issues. The first one, could it influence a reasonable patient, is the statutory standard. The Court of Appeals definition of whether or not this particular patient would have been influenced changes the degree from could to would, the reasonable patient to the particular patient, which was specifically rejected in Barclay v. Campbell.
So you're saying under the statute and our writing that a plaintiff can get up and say, I was determined to have this surgery. It made no difference to me what the risks were that I was advised of or not. I was going to have it. And that would not mean anything that a fact finder would look at. They would look at what a reasonable person would have done and the inherent risk in the procedure. I'm drawing an absurd case, but...
I know, and that's the absurd case that I have thought about. You've got Barclay at one continuum of unreasonableness, that he wouldn't have agreed to the procedure if he'd known of any risk. And if you've got that at the other end of the continuum, that they're going to have the surgery no matter what the risks are, you're just as unreasonable. But why cut off this end of the class of patients and say you're not entitled to make that decision any more than you cut end off this end? I mean, the statute has established a reasonable patient rule, that the patient has the right to make the decision, regardless of whether they decide unreasonably. The right to make that decision is necessarily governed by the amount of information that they receive from the patient has the higher degree of knowledge. The ability to exercise...
So we don't allow the squeamish patient to come in and say any facts at all that I'd known there was any problem, I would prefer to live with the situation I have than have
that's
any...
That's exactly what was...
And that's what we... And that's the trade-off that you say this statute was doing in going for a wholly objective standard. Yes. Wholly yes. Apart from the... I mean, theoretically, wholly apart from the actual facts of the claimant.
I'm not saying wholly apart from the actual facts of the claimant.
Well, from the subjective state of mind of the claimant. I mean,
But, I mean, you don't get completely away from the facts of the individual case. I mean, in Peterson v. Shields and Barclay v. Campbell, it was held that the doctor could testify on facts relating to what could influence a reasonable patient. Well, likewise, all of the evidence that has come out in this case, that she was eager for a cure of her thumb problem, even though she didn't know it was going to involve her index finger, all of that evidence goes to what could influence a reasonable patient, considering all these factors, what the problem is. In Barclay, it was the age of the patient. All of those things go into consideration. So I'm saying that the statute is clear. There's a reasonable patient
standard. So you think a plaintiff should be able to testify to their own subjective state of mind as some evidence of what a reasonable person would feel?
Well, I think if the Court of Appeals' opinion is upheld, that's what you're
going to do. Why didn't you hedge your bet in this? I mean, you're saying the causation or traditional causation issue is not proper. Why don't you submit it in an unpredicated manner and get an answer on it? But then argue to the trial judge, if the jury doesn't go with you, that you've got enough findings to render judgment. You put all your eggs in one basket, and you're going to sink or swim on the outcome.
Well, I'm going to be like Jim McKinley and tell you that at the time, I was really relying on Barclay v. King and Peterson v. Shields and myself that if the standard was a reasonable patient standard, inserting a proximate cause issue as traditionally defined would bring back in the reasonably prudent physician standard. Because foreseeability was defined as what a reasonably prudent physician would foresee. And I felt that was absolute contrary to what the law held. The only alternative, the only time that some other so-called proximate cause issue was brought up was in their objection to our issue of could this influence a reasonable patient in making a decision. They wanted to submit, would this influence a reasonable patient? And it was never considered as an additional issue because it was merely changing one word, could, to would. And the statute says could. And the cases say could.
So they did not object on the basis of the word proximate cause.
They objected that a traditionally defined proximate cause issue was not submitted. And again, I get frustrated with the label. When I use proximate cause, I have used traditionally defined or the common law definition because it has the reasonably prudent physician definition of foreseeability included in it. Now, causation, in the sense of what we're talking about, is what does disclosure do to the decision-making process? That's defined by statute. The degree is defined by statute. In a way, if the Court of Appeals is affirmed, what they've essentially done is rewrite that statute to the duty of the physician is to disclose what would influence this particular patient in making the decision. And it's simply not what the statute is. Each case is going to be determined, the status of disclosure by the doctor is going to be determined by the individual patient, whether it's reasonable or not.
Did the damage issue have any reference to the liability issues and what sum of money is defined as a result of the failure to disclose?
Right. The two issues that really sort of glossed over in this in the Court of Appeals opinion was that those specific risks that were inherent did result in Geneva McKinley as a result of either the first surgery or the second surgery. And then secondly, that the damages were a result of the occurrence in question.
Do you have the damage issue there in front of you?
Yes, I do.
And is it your position, that's the second question, that takes care of the causation? Or?
No, it's my position that there are three elements that take care of the causation. That it could influence, disclosure could influence a reasonable patient, disclosure of inherent risk, that those inherent risks actually develop as a result of the procedure, and that those damages are a result of those complications developing.
We're not at all concerned of whether or not disclosure, in fact, would have influenced this patient. We're just saying that disclosure could have influenced a hypothetical person out there.
A reasonable patient. When you consider the right that's involved, that the patient should be able to decide what to do with their own body, and to consider the policy considerations behind that right, and the unequal bargaining power of the physician and the patient, and the patient's obvious eagerness to pursue, which is a normal reaction, then I think this standard is the one that should be upheld and has been articulated by the statute.
Have you done any comparison with some of the other malpractice statutes?
I have, and I can represent to this court there is no other state that has a statutory scheme like that.
In this area?
What's that?
In the
area of informed consent, yes.
Is there anything that even remotely resembles legislative history on this part of that
subject? Yes, and if I could defer to two boxes from the there are two jurisdictions that have statutory schemes. The one that is probably the most similar is Pennsylvania, and I cited for the case Espadala versus Cadera. In that case, both of the states that have had statutory schemes have held that overrule the common law and they stick to the statute. In Segala, their statute differs a little bit in that they say a reasonable patient in the same or similar circumstances. but they say reasonable patience, and they say it does, and the court opinion, I mean, the court opinion of the Gallo de Rivera, that's the standard. It doesn't matter how the patient is dying. It's what a reasonable patient would do under the same or similar circumstances. I would submit to you that this case was handled just like that. The evidence and the statement of facts was C, the argument certainly was, here are all the facts considering what goes into the decision-making process. And that was all the evidence about her eagerness to be cured, his not anticipating that there would be those complications. All of that went into the argument of a reasonable...
Well, that's what bothers me here. I mean...
Well, I mean,
subjective evidence comes in for the jury to then make an objective determination.
Right.
We don't
and
have...
And it may be that it could be corrected by a simple definition of what is meant by a reasonable patient. Not a reasonable patient in a vacuum, a reasonable patient in a situation. But I still think it's a reasonable patient standard, and I would be very stressed by the standard becoming governed by each individual patient. People will see in every case this system will be, well, I mean, she was so eager and she finally brought consent and, that's just what you're going to see and that's going to totally take away the right for the patient to make that decision. The Segala case said it's a reasonable patient standard regardless of what the individual patient says because the recovery is based on the administration of a surgical decision in the absence of a patient's informed consent, not on whether the patient would not have gone through the operation warned of a particular danger. And I feel like the emphasis that should be involved here is lost in all the sort of labeling and arguments. The right involved is to be protected, is a protection against invasion of the health that happened in the study. And that's what happened to Susan Kimmel. She was left with complications that she couldn't reasonably have anticipated. And you go in for thumb surgery and you lose your index finger, you go in for index surgery and lose your middle finger. She had no choice over it. And that's the harm that has been done in this case.
So it becomes rather penal in nature then, if you fail to make informed consent.
I wouldn't call it penal. I would call it, a proper assessment of responsibility. If the doctor is going to assume the responsibility for making the decision that is right for the patient, then he ought to be responsible only for the complications that developed that were inherent.
Read to me the issues that were submitted.
Mm-hmm. You can read.
Issue number 14. Issue number 14 is the one that applies about standards. Is that the one you wanted to hear?
Yes.
Oh, not all of them.
Not all of them, just the applicable ones.
On damages. Physical pain and mental anguish? Oh, you want the full language. What sum of money, if any, is paid now in cash, do you find from the preponderance of the evidence that fairly and reasonably compensate and even attend for her injuries, if any? If you find from the preponderance of evidence resulting from the occurrence in question?
Well, that's fine. Now, there's nothing between that one and...
This is the third time I've come back to this, and I know it's my fault. What, if this is what the legislature has stated, I'm still bothered as to what kind of proof is germane, is it permissible, to helping the jury arrive at this standard, at making a decision. And it just seems to me the plaintiff standing up there and saying I would have never gone through this if I'd known this, it is not relevant to this issue. It almost requires an expert witness as to in the social psychology field or something as to what would be a reasonable reaction.
Well, I don't think so if you consider you know, the evidence that's been articulated by Barclay versus Campbell from an expert standpoint of, you know, how frequently this risk occurs as far as the age of the patient and how it relates to the risk, and that, I mean, all of the factual considerations, as well as all the factual considerations that the plaintiff is going to use.
That's the part that I think I'm just going to have to sort it out. All that the plaintiff is going through. I mean, unless the plaintiff is identified as the reasonable person, which some plaintiffs will be and some won't be.
I think that the evidence would be the same as it was in this case. What is the condition that's being treated? What are the risks? What's her individual lifestyle? The risk develops, how does that impact an individual lifestyle? And would a reasonable patient in that same situation be, could that person be influenced by the disclosure? I'm not sure I've answered
it. I'm just going to wrestle. It's not fair to take this time.
Okay.
Any
Thank
other
you.
Questions? Thank you.
Not only has section 6.02, but it also provides for List A procedure, which for which the medical disclosure panel has designated which risks shall be disclosed by the physician. And then it also has List B procedures, which abolish the duty of the physician to disclose anything. And then it also has the catch-all section in 6.07B, which provides that in the event a medical treatment or surgical procedure is not on List A or List B, it will then be kicked back up under your Peterson versus Shields decision concerning section 6.07B to section 6.02 of Article 4590I, which provides that the physician will be held liable for negligence in failing to disclose the risks or hazards which could influence a reasonable person in making the decision to give or withhold consent. So, amicus contend that this statutory scheme has totally replaced the common law, and to re-superimpose a common law negligence element on top of the statutory scheme is simply unnecessary, and it undoes the statutory language in 6.02 that could have influenced a reasonable person language set forth in section 6.02. I can represent to the court that I've done legislative history on this bill, and this particular bill, that section of the whole Medical Liability and Insurance Improvement Act bill, and the language has always been could through every bill, every group, all the way through the legislature, every bill in the House and in the Senate. The original bill, I have attached a copy of it to my brief, has Appendix B, and that bill was proposed by the Key Commission, which, as I'm sure y'all are all aware, was a blue panel group of scholars and doctors and lawyers and lay people who they did not recommend this bill, but they suggested it, I guess is the word, and they attached a copy of this bill, which is substantially identical to the one which was enacted by the legislature, to their report. And they felt that this bill, as indicated in their report, would solidify the duty of physicians and thereby make it easier on physicians because they would know which risks they had to disclose and for which procedures, and would also protect the interests of the patient better because it required the disclosure to be in writing, and then it created rebuttable presumptions in favor of the doctor or in favor of the patient based on the disclosure. And the Key Commission also, in their language, said that although patients often consent to a surgical procedure or medical treatment, it's not always a, quote, informed consent. They really are not informed of all the risks. So this was the legislature's way of establishing a better communication and better informed consent for all involved.
If, under this informed consent, as I recall the statute, a panel is determine what requires information and what does not require information. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Has the panel done anything on this particular surgery?
No. So that's why the under Section 6.07B of Subchapter F, Article 4590, I provide that if the medical treatment or surgical procedure is not on List A or List B, it is then the physician is under the duty otherwise imposed by law. And under Peterson v. Shields, this court interpreted the otherwise imposed by law language to mean Section 6.02 of the Act, which has the could influence a reasonable person making a decision to give withhold consent language. So that's how come we're up under 6.02. But I think that it's clear from viewing the statute as a whole in that context that this statutory scheme was intended to totally replace the common law. And that the bottom line is that the causation is written into the statute, and it is could influence a reasonable person making a decision to give or withhold consent. And that superimposing negligence, common law, negligence, proximate cause element undoes the statute in that it turns the statute into where it would literally read the physician is liable only for failure to disclose risk which would have caused a reasonable person or would have caused this patient to refuse the procedure. And that's just not what the statute says. And when you put that proximate cause element in there, that's the effect of it. So in regards to Justice Phillips' question to Bonnie, the fact that this particular patient might say, well, I would have consented to the procedure anyway, even if I had known of these risks, is a decision that the patient would be testifying to after the fact. And I don't think it's fair to penalize the patient after the fact. You're taking away their right to actually decide. If they're not informed of all the risks, and then after they say, well, yeah, really, I probably would have consented anyway, that's kind of irrelevant. I mean, the fact is, at the time they're making the decision, they're entitled to know of all the risks which could influence a reasonable person. And that's the duty under the statute which the doctor is under. And to not allow them to make that decision and force them to make that decision in hindsight is to, in effect, take away their right of self-determination. And in addition, this court's opinions in Barclay and Peterson very strongly support the position that amicus have taken that the common law has been replaced by this new statutory scheme by the legislature. In both those cases, we all recognize that it's the statute that's applicable and not the common law. And amicus would contend that to superimpose the proximate cause element at this time would be a step backwards, a step outside of the statute. That's all I have. Any questions?
Thank you. We are ready to hear argument from respondents.
Ms. Deborah Hardwick will present argument from respondents.
May it please the court. Causation is an element of the informed consent action under the medical malpractice statute. The difficulty we're having here is that the petitioners are confusing the duty element prescribed by the statute with the causation issues. Those are two separate issues. They argue that the statute provides for one issue to be presented to the jury, that the physician must disclose those risks and hazards that could have influence. That is the duty question. The next question is the failure to disclose, in fact, cause in fact, affect the decision-making process? In other words, did the non-disclosure of the risk cause the patient to undergo a procedure and expose him or herself to risks that he otherwise would have avoided had he been apprised of the risk? Petitioners seem to argue for a strict construction of the statute that does not meet the language of the statute. Section 6.02 of the statute describes that the theory of recovery is negligence. Negligence has four elements: duty, breach, causation, and damage. What the following subsections of Section 6 provide is the means by which the duty element is now to be enacted as statutory duty. There is no mention in the section of causation. There is no mention in the statute specifically of what results have to obtain for there to be a cause of action for failure to obtain informed consent. The intent of the statute is to prescribe the duty. As this court indicated in Peterson, what the court was hopeful would happen would be that procedures would either end up on list A or list B, and therefore the duty aspect of negligent cause of action could be easily handled in action for informed consent. In cases such as this, where it is a non-list procedure, Section 6.07D comes into play. The language in that section is that the healthcare provider is under the duty otherwise imposed by law. In Peterson, this court specifically held and then reaffirmed in Barclay that the duty otherwise prescribed by law is found in Section 6.02. So the only thing that the statute is purporting to deal with is the duty aspect. Prescribe the duty that the physician must meet and in a negligent cause of action. That's all the statute deals with. That's all that Peterson and Barclay help. In addition, the scheme that has been set up to deal with this procedure talks in terms of rebuttable presumptions about whether or not the physician has conformed to the duty to disclose. The statute deals with duty, the first element of a negligent cause of action. The elements in the informed consent action and an informed consent action are the same as in any other action: duty, breach, proximate cause, and damage. You cannot have a mere breach of duty and impose liability. That is what the plaintiffs are asking for. If a physician fails to disclose, the physician is absolutely liable, regardless of whether or not there was any impact on the patient's decision-making process. Non-disclosure alone cannot establish liability as the petitioner can have the court stop. There must be a cause of connection. In this day, at all times, before Article 4590I, causation has been an element. This court in Wilson v. Scott determined that there were four elements in the negligent cause of action for failure to obtain informed consent. Peterson did not overrule Wilson v. Scott. In Peterson, the court decided that the duty otherwise imposed by law is the duty imposed by Section 602, and that what the statute did was change the duty standard that the court had decided in Wilson v. Scott. And that was the only impact on the law. And back in Barclay, on page 9, the court said, the Act changed the common law locality rule concerning the physician's duty of disclosure based on the reasonable medical practitioner standard declared in Wilson v. Scott. This court has already decided what was changed about the prior law of the statute. It was just the duty. In 1974, in Clark v. Cooley, the Fifth Circuit recognized that causation was an element in informed consent action. It recognized that the court had not necessarily adopted the standard yet. It made recommendations to the court that it should be an object of the standard, but it recognized that causation was an element and affirmed the directed verdict for a doctor because the plaintiff had not put on evidence of causation. In 40 versus Memorial Hospital, a Belmont Court of Appeals decision that was NRA in 1976.
Oh, wait, are you saying you think it should, that under the statute that the causation is an objective standard?
I think that's the next question. Once we understand the fact.
Okay, so when you get to that, then I want you to address their contention that that degree of causation has been met by the issues that were submitted.
Well, in the footnote, in Dallas Court of Appeals decision, there was mentioned by the court that the proper form of the issue was not before the court's decision. And in dictum, what the court said was, we think the court should adopt such a standard. Now, basically what we've got here, we have the first issue, which is described by section 6.02. And this court in Barclay and Peterson discussed what issues have to be given to the jury to make that determination. Was the risk inherent and was it material? In other words, could it have influenced a reasonable person? That appears to be the majority rule in states around the country with respect to the duty element. The next question is, would the disclosure have influenced in a reasonable person standard? An object, a reasonable person in the plaintiff's position to withhold consent. The subjective causation standard is, would it have influenced the plaintiff? But the point is that both issues have to go. The Peterson-Barca issues have to go to the jury in order to decide what the duty was. Then you have to ask the breach issue. Is the position failed to flush? Then you have to ask the causation issue. And it can either be based on the reason whether the reasonable person would have refused treatment, if had been aware of the risk, or would the plaintiff have refused treatment, if he identified the risk. The majority rule is that the objective person standard prevails around the country. I'm aware of only two or three states that adopted the subject. There are two different questions that have to be asked the jury. And then the last question would be, of course, whether or not there's any damage. The court in the Development Court of Appeals in Florida upheld the judgment for a defendant when the jury answered the causation question that the reasonable person would not have received treatment. Found that was an issue that had to be given the jury. The jury answered against the plaintiff, and the judgment for the defendant was affirmed. And the court had already made a decision. The result of the Hartsfield versus Owens decision, the El Paso Court of Appeals decision in the NRA case in 1981, which also recognized the conviction. Now, plaintiffs rely heavily on Houston versus and on Barbara. Those cases were directed verdict cases. And the only issue before this court had to do with the proof requirements and the proper issues on the duty question. Not a decision from any further than that. There is no reasonable basis for the position that Barclay or Peterson, either one, held that causation is not an element. The court never reached that. It was a question of proof. Whether or not directed verdicts were proper, the directed verdicts were based on the duty element and the plaintiff's failure to meet their burden on the duty element. So nothing has happened in law at 4599 that would change what has always been the law in this state, that causation is an element in a form of intent action.
So are you suggesting in this court that you think the objective standard is correct, or are you just saying that's the majority rule?
The objective standard for causation?
Yes.
I think it's the correct one. I think it's a well-reasoned rule.
Then the dispute between you and the petitioners here gets down to a very narrow one of whether or not this charge is sufficient that it includes that objective standard of causation. I mean, what I heard them argue is that if you took three issues together, it does, and it's unnecessary to ask it separately again.
It's a different question, John.
The
question of whether or not the statute says, and this scheme that we're talking about in terms of what questions are asked has been addressed around the country, frankly, long before we had a lot of their jurisdictions, long before we had our statute in terms of what the standards were. But the thing is that what we're judging is the position of conduct. It used to be that we judged the position of conduct by what the reasonable person, the practitioner, would have told the patient. That's no longer law. The law now is that the physician has an obligation, as 602 provides, to disclose the risks and hazards that could have influenced the person in making the decision to give or withhold consent. So what we've had is a shift in Texas from the physician-based duty to the patient-based duty. The next question has to do with causation. Do we have a subjective standard? That is, will this patient have refused treatment, having been advised of the risk? Or do we have an objective standard? That is, would a reasonable person in the plaintiff's position have refused? In this case, the plaintiff refused to submit either issue. They never asked the jury, would the disclosure have made any difference? You can't have a mere breach without causation and imposed liability. So what I'm saying is that you're properly objected. We said you have not submitted an approximate cause issue on your informant's death. The plaintiff said causation is not an element. You don't need to ask the jury. So what we have here is a situation where the physician is dealing with a complicated and intricate situation with a woman who experienced complications long before he came to see. He came across unforeseen conditions during the treatment. And he corrected them. He performed the proper procedures. The decision was made by the jury in this case that there was no negligence in the treatment. They asked two different negligence treatment questions to the jury. The jury came back and found for the doctor on both of those. But what they want the court to decide is they want to make him a guarantor. He didn't tell about the risk. The complication resulted. He's liable, even though we have a jury who has found that the treatment was provided in accordance with the standard of care. They're circumventing. They're combining. They're trying to hurdle the fact that they did not prevail on the negligence treatment action. I think the facts even more show, in particular the ones that facts relevant to this particular situation, why the failure to know causation issue is unjust. The plaintiff, in this case, signed two consents. Both of them authorizing the physician to do whatever he deemed necessary in the event an unforeseen condition arose during surgery. It happened in both surgeries. He performed the proper procedure. The plaintiff's attorney agrees with that. Now, before the surgery, the plaintiff was extremely frustrated. She had broken her arm almost a year before. She had been treated by another physician and hadn't healed properly. She had undergone surgery to release the nerve. They had to re-break the bone. They had to do an osteotomy to try and correct the deformity. She was very anxious for her children. In between the time the osteotomy was done in November and the time the screws were to be removed from the osteotomy in March, she developed another complication. A difficulty moving the time. Dr. Strickland did not cause that. It was never issued, never complained, did anything wrong to cause that. It was another complication from the original injury. He prescribed conservative treatment. It didn't work. Before the March 26th surgery, Mrs. McKinley was told to the doctor, and she testified at trial, do whatever it takes to fix my son. Now, during the surgery, Dr. Strickland found out for the first time that there was a ruptured tendon. He performed the proper procedure. There were two tendons on the index finger. He moved one to the thumb, which left another one to move the index finger, operating in a very narrow field where he couldn't see the rest of the hand. After the surgery, she had difficulty moving the index finger. Never seen that happen before. Mrs. McKinley was even more frustrated. She told him she was anxious to have that finger taken care of. She thought she needed surgery, and she didn't want to wait. So she signed another consent form authorizing exploratory surgery. He went into the finger, and sure enough, there was another rupture in another field, and he couldn't have seen during the first surgery. He began to perform the proper procedure. She had some difficulty after that with scarring. There was a second procedure by another hand surgeon during the summer. The jury found that she had no past or future physical impairment. They gave her zero damages for that. And they gave her zero damages for future pain and suffering and no luggage. She got better. Now, the question is, if causation had been asked of the jury, what would the jury have decided? What was the effect of the non-disclosure on the plaintiff? Would she have had the surgery? Would a reasonable person in her set of circumstances have had the surgery? Dr. Strickland testified he's never seen this happen before. The plaintiff's own expert testified that these risks were very remote and very minimal, and in his experience, it was the kind of procedure that people would have had having been advised of those risks. So we don't want
where,
to look.
Where does the remoteness come in the statutory standard? Is that the inherent to the procedure performed?
Yes, in the materiality issue.
If it's an ab reaction.
Yes. So you see, the point is that what the petitioners are asking the court to do, we've got complications of procedures that were properly performed. They want to hold the doctor responsible for that because he failed his book, a certain risk that he resolved. But what if she would have had the surgery anyway? Or the reasonable person in her condition would have had. And the disclosure is of no legal effect. And that's what we're trying to get the jury to act and be asked. There's an interesting letter in the record from a juror to the trial court. The juror is not happy with the result, with the questions that were asked. One juror wrote to the judge, asking why they were never asked to judge Dr. Higgins if there was nothing wrong, or if they even did, really had to cause these problems for her. Even the jury was frustrated with the charge and not having been asked that question.
Are you saying that these abnormalities would have happened anyway, absent the surgery?
What I'm saying is that
she had ruptured tendons, you're telling me, and that these would have all openly shown up whether she had surgery or didn't have surgery.
Your Honor, I'm not a physician, so I can't answer that. If you know someone like I just said, you went during the course of the trial, that there are two tendons on the allows for the transfer and the interruption. Of course, you know, the first tendon transfer evidently developed some 6 to 8 months after the original injury. And it was established that Dr. Strickland was not the cause. But the point is that there was surgery performed, and when one tendon was removed, it left a finger without the tendon that Dr. Strickland thought was in place. So there were complications from the procedure. They wanted at fault for the negligence of the performance procedures and the manner in which he performed and the fact he chose to do it. And they're trying to hold him responsible for the result of the procedure, even though he wasn't negligent. They tied the causation, when they say the causation elements are there, they tied it into the treatment. The cause in fact has to be tied into the decision making process. They asked the juror, did he do something wrong with performing surgery? Is that what caused these problems with the tendon? The jury said no. So then they said, well, did he do something wrong in failing to advise the patient about these risks? The jury said yes. Did he have any effect? Not on the treatment and the way it was performed, but on the decision making process. And that's the difference. And they want to solve the two areas and hold response, hold physicians absolutely liable for complications that result from surgery or treatment in the event of non-disclosure of risk. Not the weapon on work. Not the negligence cause of action test. Now, all jurisdictions that have adopted informed consent based on the negligence action require causation. And I cited to the court a list of the ones that follow the objective standard. So I think they're incorrect when they refer to the Pennsylvania case. I'm sorry, but I didn't get the news brief from yesterday. I haven't investigated what Pennsylvania statutory scheme is, if there is one. There's no mention in the case about a statutory scheme. But the difference in Pennsylvania is their informed consent action is based on battery. And the case says that. This court in Wilson says failure to obtain informed consent is not a battery action, it's a negligence. They find an Oregon case which they say shows no causation. That's not what the Oregon case says. In Oregon, they had a statutory scheme that prescribed duty, and the court adopted the subjective causation standard. Now, this court has never ruled on what the proper standard is. The plaintiff says there is no element. We say there is, and then the court then needs to decide how the issue should be worked. Dallas Court of Appeals decided that causation is an option. That was the decision. And in a footnote, suggested that the proper issue was the subjective issue. I think the proper issue should be the objective issue. But the point is, and the issue before this point, is that there should be an issue. Now, why should Texas adopt the objective issue? First of all, for well-reasoned approach. In negligent actions, causation is always viewed with foresight. In the position before the event happened, not hindsight. The same issue that Judge Phillips was mentioning in terms of looking back. The Cobbs case, which is the California Supreme Court case that's referenced in our brief, discusses the dangers of the subjective approach. As does the Canterbury decision, which is the D.C. Circuit decision for the early 70s, which discusses that problem as well. You have the danger of a patient, after a complication has resulted, looking back, just like Mrs. McGilley did in this case, and saying, oh, but I wouldn't have the surgery, they told me. Not the proper perspective. And that's the real danger of the subjective approach, is that there's too much credence placed on the plaintiff saying that. It has to be from the physician beforehand. What I'm suggesting to you is that Mrs. McKinley said afterwards, I wouldn't have done it. But if you look at all the evidence of her physician before the surgery, she would have had it. She would have had the surgery. And I suggest to you that if the jury had been asked, they would have done it. And the California Supreme Court specifically cautioned against putting too much emphasis on the plaintiff's hindsight. Second reason is that any of the courts in this state that have addressed this particular, the deformity issue, have already used an objective standard. You've got the Forney case, the Fifth Circuit in Clark, indicating that the objective standard seems to be the more well-reasoned approach, having examined, having been decided around the country. In the Gus case, which the court recently decided that informed consent was not before this court, but the lower court had addressed it. Although the decision was whether or not there was any evidence of causation, the issue submitted to the trial court in that case would be the objective causation standard. And the court did not comment that it was an erroneous standard, just made every issue change. Finally, the adopted the reasonable person approach has been adopted with respect to the duty standard. For consistency's sake, it would make sense to adopt the reasonable person approach standard on the causation element as well. And because the issue could be phrased in terms of the reasonable person in plaintiff's position, the jury could then take into proper account the circumstances surrounding the plaintiff at the time the decision was made. Wouldn't jeopardize anyway the plaintiff's right to make the decision. The commentators in this study have recognized that causation is an element. Jim Perdue, in the Law of Medical Malpractice, has a whole section on how proximate cause is required in an informed consent action, and that the only issue under the medical malpractice statute, and that the only issue the court has not decided is whether or not it's a subjective or objective standard. He says that the object of standard is the better reasoned approach. Similarly, Dean Keaton has written in my decision of process a whole discussion on how causation is an element. And talks about how the proper balance of the object of issue that's phrased in terms of the reasonable person is plaintiff's position. So when you look at all the courts, all around the country, causation is an element. The commentators have said, the lower courts have said, the idea that we can have absolute liability in informed consent cases cannot stand. The Court of Appeals directly held that causation is an element in an informed consent action. The court should be affirmed. At trial, the defendant timely objected to the failure to submit the issue of causation. The plaintiff refused to allow the submission and therefore waived their right.
No, the plaintiff didn't refuse to allow the submission. The trial judge refused to allow the submission.
Your Honor, I beg to differ, but the record does reflect that the court asked the plaintiff, are you sure you don't want to submit, and she said no.
That's right. I mean, she bears the responsibility, but it is the court's charge.
I understand. But the point is that the right to have a determination on that issue is gone in this case. It's been waived. Reversing and rendering proper decisions by the Court of Appeals. And I urge this Court to affirm the decision of the Office of Appeals.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, let me dispose of two matters that Ms. Hardwick mentioned that since they're not the case. First, Ms. McKinley is not asking for any standard of strict liability. I don't think the medical profession would have passed this statute in 1977 with such a requirement in it. And the statute does not require it. We're not arguing for it. Secondly, causation is required by the statute. However, it is a different breed cat, if we report, than we are traditionally accustomed to in ordinary negligence action. What I think happened here is that the legislature, in enacting a statutory scheme on informed consent, modified, obviously, the traditional notion of proximate cause. In this case, we have cause in fact. So the real issue concerns the foreseeability issue. And so the legislature determined in the statutory scheme that the disclosure panel would determine foreseeability for those risks on List A, and by same token that there would be no foreseeability for the risk on List B. So then we are left, how do you determine foreseeability in those instances where it's not on either list? Well, as this Court stated, in the Peterson case, you go back to the duty established by law, and that's the standard established by the legislature in Section 6.02 as to the reasonable person standard. So what I'm suggesting to you, if it pleases the Court, causation is required, is simply that the legislature has modified the foreseeability prong of what we traditionally know as proximate cause. And the legislature did not speak only to duty, as the Court of Appeals suggested, and as Ms. Hardwick has suggested. The legislature dealt both with duty and causation in this same Section 6.02. As this Court has recently observed in El Chico v. Pooh, duty is the function of several interrelated factors, the foremost and dominant consideration being foreseeability of the risk. I would suggest to the Court that in this case, under these facts, foreseeability by Dr. Strickland's own testimony is established as a matter of law. So we really don't need to worry about the foreseeability problem under the facts of this case. Then the issue becomes, was there cause in fact? Now, not cause in fact of any sort of negative.
Why is foreseeability established as a matter of law?
By virtue of Dr. Strickland's own testimony that yes, these were inherent risks of injuries to the tendon in this particular type of surgery. In other words, the doctor knew going in that this could happen. This could be a risk of injury. It's also undisputed that he failed to warn Mrs. McKinley. And we're not claiming, obviously, that the doctor was negligent, as Ms. Hardin suggests. The doctor obviously was, quote, not at fault in terms of a negligent standard. However, the doctor was at fault because he made a decision to do something to her body that was her decision to make. That's the real crux of this case. The doctor made the decision when it really was Mrs. McKinley's decision to make. And under the informed consent scheme that the legislature established, that establishes liability. Now, if it pleases the Court, cause in fact in this case was established by question number 5 of the charge. Did Geneva McKinley have the following conditions as a result of the surgery? The limited extension of the index finger, the middle finger, and scarring of the tendon. These were risks which the jury found were not only inherent, but that would influence a reasonable person in making a decision to consent to the procedure. So questions 4 and 5, I think, establish cause in fact in this particular case. with respect to the argument that negligence was not established, that's clear in the jury's answers here. However, if there is one piece of legislative history that is clear, in the Keaton Commission report on page 20, the very first paragraph indicates that an injured person may recover damages for adverse consequences of medical and surgical procedures, even where the procedures are performed carefully and in accordance with the best medical or surgical practices. Now, when does that happen? When can the patient recover under those circumstances? If the health care provider does not make a reasonable disclosure to the patient. So, a health care provider can be liable in the absence of negligence, if it pleases the court, if he fails to make a proper disclosure of risk inherent, in this case, risk inherent to a particular surgical procedure. And I'm glad to see that Ms. Hardwick is quoting Mr. Jim Perdue, because in his latest writing on this in the Advanced Personal Injury Law Course in 1988, put out by the State Bar on page T13, he states that the plaintiff in McKinley versus Strickland did properly submit the theory of informed consent, and that the language found in section 6.02, coupled with this court's earlier interpretations, he says it abolishes the common law proximate cause element in informed consent suits. And I think that's correct. We do not have the traditional notion of proximate cause. And why? The reason is found in the foreseeability definition of proximate cause. The traditional definition is whether or not the physician could reasonably have foreseen the risks, etc. Well, in this case, it's established as a matter of law. And in those other cases, the disclosure panel determines that issue. So we feel that Mrs. McKinley properly submitted the charge, the jury so found, and we respectfully ask the court to uphold the trial court's judgment.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will now take another brief recess.
Everybody, please rise.